maybe what's necessary is that women talk more about their experiences with, you know, either regretted sex or bad sex, whatever you want to call it, sexual experiences that they consented to at the time and did want to do at the time, and then that came with regret afterwards. Because you're right, there's no room in our current discourse for that.
Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Girl Boss Interrupted. I'm your host, Helen Roy. In this episode, I very much enjoyed speaking with Inez Stepman. Inez is a senior policy analyst at the Independent Women's Forum and host of her own podcast, High Noon with Inez Stepman, in which she has conversations with heterodox thinkers on a variety of important cultural and political subjects. And like myself, she is interested in women's issues, and especially interested because she describes herself in her Twitter bio as an anti-feminist. So I thought, you know, if someone is going so far as to describe themselves in this particularly stark way, this starkly countercultural way, then they must have something important to say. And she certainly does, and she certainly did in this episode. So I'm confident that you will enjoy it. And if you do, please do not forget to like, subscribe, leave a comment, and share with your friends. I want to shout out to all my listeners as well. I've very much been enjoying your feedback on Twitter. If you're listening and you're not on Twitter, you can follow me at Helen_of_Roy and connect with me there. I'd love to hear more from you. So enjoy the episode, and I will speak to you again in 2 weeks' time. So hi, Inez. Welcome to Girl Boss Interrupted.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about your writing and this new podcast. I think it's going to be a series of really great discussions on what it means to be a woman in 2022, the kind of discussions that I don't think are happening in enough mainstream places.
Well, thanks for saying that. I hope so. It's what interests me. So I figured if I'm the only, I don't know, I'm a pretty average person. So if I'm interested in this, like, somebody else has to be interested in it too. Right. But anyway, yeah. We'll start, like I start all of these interviews, and I want to know about your life and how you got to where you are right now.
I guess where I am right now is a person with anti-feminist in my Twitter bio. So the way I got there, I think, I grew up in a very, very liberal town, Palo Alto, California. And it was more than just sort of politically left-wing. It was very, very aggressively feminist in a particular way that I think you describe on this podcast as girl bossing, right? So the idea that women should and ought to be in full career competition with men. Nobody in my high school ever grew up and questioned the idea that that women could do anything, that girls could do anything, boys could do. That was very, very much part of the you go girl attitude that I grew up around. I'd say my parents are immigrants from Poland. They were very supportive of, obviously, of me as their daughter and the career I might want to go into. But they weren't explicitly sort of girl bossy feminists the way that the environment was. But as to how I got away from that, I think it started to probably happen in my early 20s or maybe even definitely in college. I just sort of noticed that this was really, really stressful for a lot of the women around me, particularly the combination that you point to, Helen, of this sort of sexual liberation and casual sex lifestyle combined with a very, very aggressive careerism that leaves very little room. The traditional critique, of course, is that it leaves very little room for family and for bearing children. It also leaves very little room for the kind of relationships that I think women really, really care about, and the things that make them ultimately fulfilled and happy. I don't think that it was verboten when I was growing up to say something like this, but you know, women women seem to be on average much more invested in having personal relationship networks and investing that with a lot of meaning than men do. That's not to say that men don't have close friends or that they don't care about their family relationships and their family duties at all. That's not what I'm saying. But women, they seem much more central to what makes us happy in life. And I just started noticing that. I started noticing that most of the women that I knew who were pursuing this kind of dual track of, you know, sort of having a aggressively casual sex life and having a very, very aggressive career, they seemed stressed out. A lot of them were on medication. A lot of them were lonely. And they didn't have a vocabulary about which to talk about any of these things to each other. So they always came out in some, in my view, sideways thing about how the world was unfair because it was still misogynistic or the patriarchy was still keeping them down. And that quickly became kind of obvious to me that it wasn't an exterior force. It was the choices that they were making that were making them so stressed out. So that's kind of how I got there. And then, you know, read all the usual crime think on the internet, some of which I firmly agree with and some of which I think also denies individuality of both men and women. But yeah, I think that's how I got here.
Yeah, absolutely. What kind of crime think did you read?
I read some of those, the pickup logs and the manosphere kind of stuff, which seemed to me to be at the time, on the one hand, saying truths that were obviously observable. And for me at the time, it very much explained the world in a way that, or at least explained the relations I was seeing around me in college and young adulthood in a way that the current narrative in the culture did not. Yeah. And then I think as I got out of my 20s and into my 30s, I started to question a lot of that as well. I do think that it, again, because in a similar way as it did describe the hookup environment quite well, and it like explained to me why, you know, I would see people making one decision or another. And so that seemed to me to be a theory that fit the observable reality better than the one I had been given in Palo Alto. Now that I get older, I also look around and see that it no longer fits either fully, that it does somehow simplify sex relations, that there isn't just the sexual game. Yes, there's an evolutionary component to this. Yes, a lot of what they write about pickup culture and what attracts women is true. But we are also individuals with free will and, you know, sort of, for example, sets of values. And this is not purely a game of animalistic mating rituals. And I think that a lot of those blogs tend to flatten that reality. They really ignore the reality of companionship, the reality of finding somebody who matches you in values, and the very real cooperation that goes on between men and women, whether within the family context or in a relationship context. And I just think it's too flat. But at the time, I found it way more predictive of the actual observed reality around me than any of the sort of pablum about feminism that I had been sold in Palo Alto. So for a while, I was more in that camp. Now I still call myself an anti-feminist because I think, and we can talk about that, but because I think that the central premise of feminism, really going all the way back to the first wave, going all the way back to even the early 1800s, has been that sex differences are, to a greater or lesser extent, socially constructed. And I think that that's simply false. And I think what the project in front of us is rather to recognize the biological differences between men and women, whether those are physical in the way that we're talking now, or whether those are neurological, psychological, and then try to build a society, which there will never be a perfect sort of relations between men and women. But to try to build a society where those relations are more harmonious and make more people happy of both sexes, I think that's kind of a societal project. But I disagree with feminism central in my view, and I can back it up if we want to keep going the discussion in terms of which writers and so on. But I think pretty much with very few exceptions, all feminist writers of every wave are attempting to try to take nature as much as possible out of the discussion.
Yes, it's I had a similar experience actually with being sort of red-pilled by the you know, like Chateau Artiste and some of these guys who had really interesting things to say about the sexual marketplace, so to speak. And
And there's that there, it definitely reflects a certain reality that feminism really, really wants to deny, because they, the Manosphere, which is sort of a loose conglomeration for our listeners of like, pickup artistry, men's rights activists, men going their own way, and also just as generally sort of anti-feminist men, or men who are vocal about being hurt by this. And, you know, they were very much depersoned. There was a huge project to sort of shut that down in, what, 2015 or something like that? It was like Gamergate triggered that. Anyway, there's a whole thing there. But yeah, but I certainly agree with you that, you know, feminism's weakness and the reason why feminism's central weakness is the reason why those blogs and that realm became so powerful and was had such influence over so many people is that, you know, the feminist sort of impulse is to deny reality. And we see this, and, you know, you can counter that with a really, sort of black and white game-like description of reality, which is what they did, and then return to nuance, which is like what hopefully people do eventually. But yeah, that denial of reality is really central. And we're seeing it now with William Thomas dominating people in the swim meets and just you know, all of this stuff, it all comes from the core of denying material reality. So I kind of want to ask you about that. And like, let's get to your self-description of anti-feminist. Why you've sort of explained already why you call yourself an anti-feminist, but what does it mean to be an anti-feminist?
I think it just means recognizing that the differences between the sexes are not socially constructed. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that, for example, men and women, there should be, you know, no protections under the law that protect against some kinds of sex discrimination. Because I could think of plenty of kinds of sex discrimination that are disconnected in some way from the biological differences between men and women. But there are many kinds of sex discrimination, which the word discrimination has such a negative connotation in our modern lingo, but in the law just means a distinguishing between two different, you know, camps or groups of people. And in the case of sex, it's completely legitimate to distinguish between men and women in many cases where those biological differences become relevant, right? So now we're in the crazy position of allowing men who identify as women into women's prisons in several states.
Yeah.
Keeping men out of women's prisons is a discrimination on the basis of sex, right? Same thing when you request a female pat down officer from the TSA, right, at the airport, because you're uncomfortable being patted down by an individual of the opposite sex, a man, right? These are the kind of quote unquote discriminations that we make every day that are based very much in biological reality and the differences between men and women. And just another note on these sort of game blogs before we move on. I mean, I think one, they did express a lot of real pain that was legitimate. And I think one of the most important things they did is raise issues in the criminal justice system, in family courts, yeah. where fathers were or still are being put in a position of not having, let's say, the same access to their children. Right. And so I think there's a lot of legitimacy there. Mm-hmm. I will say that I think when it goes beyond criticizing a culture that encourages perhaps the worst vices of femininity in women, but goes to actually critiquing femininity itself as useless, yeah. I find it to be kind of embittered beyond what's justifiable, right? There seems to be, in the same way that there's this feminist reaction to ignore the importance of female beauty and to, for example, advance, you know, what is the whole movement of the health at every size movement, mm-hmm. that you know, obesity is beautiful, that women at age 40 are just as attractive as, you know, 20-year-olds, like these are obvious falsehoods that, you know, women don't want to confront, or many women in our society tries to pretend are not true. These are realities that absolutely are true. Mm-hmm. But in the same way, there, I think there's some, a lot of folks in the sort of manosphere element online who are almost angry at the fact that women like dominant men as mm-hmm. a function of biology, that they like assertive men. They almost feel that it's unfair. Well, I don't know. I think that the same feelings are probably at play when, you know, we put Lizzo on the front cover of a magazine and say, this is beautiful, right? It's yeah. the same kind of unfairness of nature. But somehow when it's women who are exercising those kinds of natural judgments, it's illegitimate. I think that right. that's, I think that's one of my major problems with that sphere. Yeah. And then the second part is, of course, there aren't just the natural judgments involved. Yes, attraction between men and women is very important. And you probably shouldn't be with someone to whom you're not attracted, right? In that basic way. The reality is out of the pool of people that we find attractive, right? Which is not nearly as subjective as modern culture would have us think. There are a lot of other considerations that go into picking a long-term partner mm-hmm. that really seem downplayed on those blogs that are focused, I guess, understandably in a hookup culture on the short-term and the casual. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think these blogs are totally useless, or that certainly don't agree with sort of scrubbing them out of the internet, or I just do think that they become a little bit too embittered when they inveigh actually against femininity or feminine sexual selection. Right. That sounds to me just like the flip side of feminism.
Absolutely. I was just about to say that there's a temptation sometimes when you define yourself in opposition to something else to become the precise inverse, which is not, in fact, effective opposition in the long term, because you just sort of inherit and like take on the shape of that thing, but with all of its faults, but flip them over. I agree with you on that too. I think that's really where those guys sort of find their limitations. Additionally, you know, another aspect I think of the mainstream feminist worldview is, in addition to denying, you know, material reality to a certain extent, or attempting to really redefine it, there's also a denial of like spiritual reality. And this, you know, dehumanize is kind of a funny term, but I think that there is a tendency to dehumanize men that gets flipped on the other side too. And so, you know, you start to see like the pickup artist crowd sort of dehumanizing women and viewing them truly as, you know, sex objects to be manipulated and used for a man's personal pleasure or whatever. And that's really not good either. That's not good for general, you know, relations between the sexes. But how do you avoid that as somebody who identifies as an anti-feminist?
I think the reason, again, that I identify as an anti-feminist is because I think there is a central error in just about the entirety of at least academic feminism. And even before, I guess it depends if you consider feminists in the 1800s as academic or not. But I think that there is an error that runs straight to where we are today. I think one of the ways in which I depart a little bit from perhaps other conservatives even, or mainstream conservatives on this issue, is I don't really think that it's a tenable position to get off a train just at the last stop, right? So like mm-hmm. to sort of to embrace first wave feminism, to embrace second wave feminism, I think the central arguments in favor of both of those waves, which is not to say that I deny every single like policy sort of advancement. There are some things I think that have been good policy reforms under those waves. But I think the central tenets of those waves, again, really says that everything with regard to everything important in life, sex ought not to matter. So I'll give you an example, right? Even in the 1970s or even before then, right? Feminists were arguing that it ought not really to matter whether you were a man or a woman for the career choices that you make. right? We think about that as a very modern argument. I don't think it is a brand new argument. I think it's been around for a while. The idea being that your sex is really not, it's socially constructed. A lot of the consequences and gender roles are socially constructed. And therefore, we should be at minimum, completely neutral as a society. We should have nothing to say about how the choices that a girl makes as opposed to a boy, right? Growing up, choices about career, about family. Now, I'm not obviously advocating for coercion of any kind, but I think that society inevitably has to have a script. That doesn't mean that every single individual is going to follow the script, or that there aren't exceptions or even large minorities of people who end up taking a different path. Like, that's the essence of what it means to live in a free society. But I don't think that gender scripts are inherently oppressive. I think they're kind of unavoidable. And we certainly have a gender script now. And mm-hmm. that is that if you are a young woman of any intelligence or ambition, that you should complete at minimum your college education by age 22. You should spend your 20s either continuing in your education or sleeping around. And having fun. I would argue that it's not that fun, but I'm saying even just sort of putting aside questions of actually looking for a partner or starting a family until well into your 30s, that is a script that our society advances. It's not the case that you can be completely sort of libertarian and neutral about mm-hmm. what it is to be a successful woman or a successful man in our society. So I think those roots of that critique were always there. And I also think a lot of people want to make a distinction between sort of gender roles and biology, like a really, really sharp distinction, when the reality is that gender roles arose from a recognition of that biology, and that biology is more than skin deep, right? It's not just that men and women have different parts, right, under their clothes. It's not just that they have different gametes or sex, you know, secondary sex characteristics, or that, you know, men can do the 200 meter butterfly, as we're seeing, much faster than women, right? Those are, at the end of the day, the superficial physical differences. But there are much deeper differences biologically between men and women, starting with the fact that our brains are quite different, which is something that was easily confirmable in social and actual science studies until, you know, half a second ago, where the academy, it became very unpopular and difficult to do such studies in the academy. Even when it comes to, for example, something like memory. Women can remember objects in a room related to each other better than men. In other words, they have better associative memory. Men have better memory reading things down a list, right? Men have better binocular vision. Women have better peripheral vision. We have evolved in probably, you know, thousands or even millions of ways to be very different. And those differences impact not just, you know, what we have between our legs, but what we have between our ears. Mm-hmm. And so I think feminism has always denied the what's between your ears part, and therefore has very little leg to stand on when finally at the end of the train, somebody says, well, you know, perhaps even the parts outside are irrelevant. I'll put it this way, if sex ought to be and is irrelevant to the decisions you make about your career, about your family, about having children, about friendship, about love, Why shouldn't they be irrelevant to the 200 meter, right? I mean, right. To me, this is a logical sort of sequence of ideas, and that's not to say there are no distinctions. Of course, it's more obvious it's more obvious to see that there are differences on the track, you know, on the like between men and women when they're running in a track race against each other. But I would argue that the differences, psychological differences, are quite obvious as well. And to deny those, I think, inevitably leads to, if you say everything else is irrelevant about biological sex, you can have any career you want, in any order you want. You can have, you can reproduce however you want. I don't even want to say have children. You can reproduce however you want. It shouldn't factor in, you know, sort of biological considerations shouldn't factor in to who you select as a mate, in what order and what time you make decisions in life about relationships, family, friendship. Right. If you say it doesn't matter for all of that, it seems to me to be inevitable that somebody would eventually say, well, if it doesn't matter for anything important, why are we why do we have these lone holdouts where we recognize that biologically women and men are different, or men, right. biologically women and men are different. So right. that's really why, that's the heart of why I do call myself an anti-feminist. As a matter of practicality, it's never been clear to me why conservatives are so anxious to pick up on the word feminism. And to argue that, you know, conservatives are the quote unquote real feminists, especially since less than a third of American women actually even identify as feminists, like they wouldn't call themselves feminists. So I'm not at all sure. I'm not saying that the two thirds are anti-feminist, right? But I'm not sure why we would chase so hard after a term that is so apparently toxic among American women.
Yeah, that's interesting. We've decided to just sort of completely throw the Phyllis Schlafly contingent to the wayside. Who cares about them, right? and this desperate need to appeal to, the cool kids or whatever. I can't relate. I don't. That's where I think it comes from. Is like, just conservatives need to. Maybe it's like a jealousy or something. And it is true that the other side has more power in media and culture and the rest of it. But I almost feel like if, you know, by pretending like you're something you're not, you're like losing even harder.
I really think that's true, that women are losing really harder by pretending to be something they're not. If you look at happiness data in surveys, self-reported happiness, it's not just that happiness among both men and women has declined markedly since 1970. So you have both sexes less happy today than mm-hmm. you did in 1970. In addition, women's happiness has declined vis-a-vis men's. So the gap between male and female happiness has actually expanded even as both sexes have become more unhappy, right? So women have become more unhappy faster than men have over the same mm-hmm. period of time. That's not happiness isn't the only measure, and there's lots of, it's kind of a fraught thing to try to sociologically measure as well. Self-reported happiness. So for example, I don't buy any of those surveys that say, for example, that Sweden and Finland and Denmark are the happiest places on earth or whatever. A large part of that has to do with, you know, cultural strictures on reporting your happiness and whether or not it's seen as socially desirable to have mental illnesses and so on. But I do think that we're reaching a point very quickly where both sides, even the left and even feminists, are recognizing that something is deeply broken mm-hmm. in our sex relations. Mm-hmm. The only question that remains to me is not will we grapple with the fact that pretty much everybody is unhappy with the current state of affairs, but how we're going to move out of that state of affairs. And I think there's a real danger that we do what we have in other instances, which is, for example, when women started to recognize that the hookup culture was leaving a lot of wounds, psychological wounds, particularly with women, we try to cram it into the consent box, right? This legalistic framework that if you're not happy after, if you regret, for example, having a casual encounter with a man, and even if you feel very deeply about this and the pain that you have after, for example, he ignores you the next day or goes out with another girl, we try to cram that into this consent framework. And mm-hmm. in the process, we created something that is, frankly, tyrannical and unfair for men, right? The same conduct, the legality of the conduct will depend on the charm of the man in question. I mean, this is like close mm-hmm. to criminalizing awkwardness, right?
Right.
But we just continue to build essentially a replacement for the guardrails around sexual morals that had been in place in the previous generation. But we built those guardrails in a completely like cockamamie legalistic way that created a lot of unfairness and a lot of pain, additional pain, both legal and psychological. So that's what I fear more than anything. I think everybody at this point, there are very few defenders of the status quo at this point. And there was that article that came out about the end of sex positivity, I think in the New York Times mm-hmm. or the New Yorker. I think there's broad agreement that this isn't working. What I'm scared about is how that translates into change and whether it becomes, you know, more in the direction of Me Too, where we go down the Catherine McKinnon route of saying essentially women can't consent to sex because they're too powerless in society, which is just flagrantly, obviously nonsense. Or whether we actually turn around and say, maybe there was something to having some of these norms in place. Maybe there was a purpose for them. And maybe we need, even though we can't completely, I just don't believe in that it's possible, even if desirable, to sort of just turn back the clock. How we can go about building new norms around sexual behavior that recognize both the natural interests and desires of both sexes, and how to build some guardrails around that that are more conducive to human happiness.
What do you think that might look like?
You know, I really don't know. It's a good question. I know what they used to look like, and that involved a heavy dose of shame,
right?
Against behavior.
Slut shaming. Oh no.
I don't know what our current culture, whether we can have a return to shame that doesn't look like social mobbing. So I guess I worry about that. I'm very interested to see where it goes. I don't really have a satisfying answer. Obviously, I would like to see some, frankly, I think what's really missing in our discourse is a way to talk about bad sex that isn't consent. I think that's just really missing. And we see that in the tail end of Me Too stories, like Aziz Ansari, Aziz Ansari story that was published in Babe, and even a lot of the current discourse, or like West Elm Caleb, right? We don't have a way to talk about bad sex that that isn't just about consent. And so there was all that discussion, like, oh, is this guy basically a borderline, you know, rapist? When in fact, the guy is just, he's doing what a certain percentage of men have always done. He's doing what is going to get him laid. And there are only a few ways to deal with that. One, the society has to have pretty strict controls on it. In the past, they had pretty strict controls, social controls on female sexuality to avoid that. So, you know, how we can restore that without, going into, again, this line about consent, which is completely beside the point. Like, there's a consent app. You can click just leaving aside how unsexy it is to pull out an app and say, do you consent? That just begs the question, right? Was she really coerced when she clicked the green button? What did the man whisper in her ear to make her these are questions that fundamentally cannot be adjudicated legally or under the bracket or the framework of consent. So I don't know what it looks like yet, but I would like to see some discussion about what counts as good sex and bad sex having nothing to do with consent. That's consent has to do with a very tiny category, or lack of consent has to do with a very tiny category of human sexual relations, those that are actually criminal rape. And it's not really a useful construct to talk about all the other kinds of sex that human beings can have, and from, you know, the very positive and loving to the exploitative and sort of demeaning. That whole spectrum can all be under the framework of consent. Consent is not a good enough lodestar to distinguish between good and bad sex. So I think that's maybe where we would have to start, is an acknowledgement of certain aspects of male and female nature and biology when it comes to sex. And two, you know, we have to throw out the idea that consent is actually what distinguishes bad sex from good sex, because it really only applies to a tiny percentage of sexual relations. And for the rest, it's just really not helpful.
Yeah, I think the marker for, or the what distinguished good sex from bad sex, and I'm not talking about like whether it was pleasurable or not, but just simply whether it was like legitimate or good in a more objective sense, that would have once been marriage, right? Good sex is inside of marriage. Bad sex is outside of marriage. But we've sort of found ourselves now in this way more complicated situation where that has been sort of taken away or that standard has been taken away. And you're right. There is no consent is what everything must collapse into. But I think another reason perhaps why there's no way to talk about quote unquote bad sex is because there's no way to talk about sexual regret. Regret is very powerful. You know, it's something that you almost feel involuntarily. It's so real. It's so built in. But especially sexual regret, and especially for women, I think, you know, but that's like one element of this that I think makes things complicated, is that in a sexually liberated environment, there's so much, you know, weight sort of placed on your ability to be free sexually, you know, whatever that means, that if you make a free choice that was the wrong choice, you know, there's almost like this fear, this pressure that like you are shaming your feminist forebears if you express any sort of regret for a decision that you've made. You know, there's that element of it. Like you can't regret sex. You can only express that you didn't want it the way that it, you know what I mean? So
that's a good way of putting it. You're not allowed to express regret. I was calling it bad sex, but you're not allowed to express regret for sexual decisions that you've made for reasons other than force or exploitation.
Right.
And I think we really need, perhaps in the same way as we're starting to see detransitioners come out in the trans context and talk about their experiences, maybe what's necessary is that women talk more about their experiences with, you know, either regretted sex or bad sex, whatever you want to call it, sexual experiences that they consented to at the time and did want to do at the time, and then that came with regret afterwards. Yeah. Because you're right, there's no room in our current discourse for that. And maybe that's a first step forward to rebuilding some things, making it simply okay for young women to say, I did this, I'm an adult and I consented to it, but it felt really bad afterwards and I felt really regretful about it and I felt demeaned by it. And I'm just putting it out there into the world so that, you know, maybe another woman won't make that decision that I did, and I'm going to make different decisions going forward. You know, you also mentioned marriage as a norm. And while that's true, the norm was even sort of deeper than that, or broader than that, I should say. If you go back even into the 1930s, 40s, 50s, it was still, there were certainly more men and women both getting married as virgins than today. But it is equally true that even a lot of the men and women who were not virgins going in, the term premarital sex, right, is completely anachronistic today. But that really did describe even the extramarital sex that was happening, for example, in the 1950s, for the most part. What you had a lot less of is what I would call casual sex, right? And this is something that feminist sociologists trot out, like, oh, you know, even in the 1950s, lots of people were having sex before marriage. Yes, that's true, but they were having premarital sex. They were having sex within relationships that were assumed to be headed in the direction of marriage. And biologically, of course, if the woman got pregnant from those relations, then there was enormous societal pressure to marry, which was not as much of a disaster as it would be today. Because if a man and woman were having sex in 1940, chances are, and I'm not, obviously there were exceptions, but chances are they were in a serious relationship that was probably headed towards marriage anyway. And the kind of shotgun wedding was just speeding things up, right? Mm-hmm. Versus today, where you have men and women who, you know, may not even know each other's names, and certainly know nothing about their compatibility long term, who are having these casual relations, that's a very different sociological phenomenon than premarital sex in 1950. I want to separate those two things, Because so just sociologically, and we can, you know, I'm not an expert on the theological structures against this, being a, you know, atheist Jew myself, but that sociologically, there's a huge difference between the kind of genuinely premarital sex that was going on in the 1940s and 1950s, in terms of the societal consequences of it, was much, much more minimal, because most of the time, if those relationships ended up producing children, those children were then raised in a married household, because both because society demanded it more than it does now, and second, because the pairs to begin with were not, you know, random people who had never met each other before, but usually people who had been dating for quite some time and knew each other pretty well. And so the idea that they should marry and spend the rest of their lives together raising those children that resulted from their premarital sex was not a crazy one in the way that it would be now. You know, if you just met this guy and you don't even know his last name, that the idea that if a child results from that union, that these two strangers are now going to be thrown together for life, like, that sounds way crazier than it did in 1940.
Yeah, the dating app abortion industrial complex will definitely, I think, relies on what's going on here. People just not knowing each other. I mean, that's huge, and it is fundamentally different. So we're getting close to your hard out at 1 o'clock, but let me just ask you the final question. What do you think, considering everything that we've talked about today, what do you think, if you had to boil it down, is required of a virtuous woman living in the 21st century? What does it mean to be a virtuous woman living, you know, living now, wading through all this stuff?
I mean, I think virtue is a very high bar most of us don't meet. But I think that starts with knowing yourself, which is not at all the same thing as listening to yourself, or, you know, whatever, like, sort of gauzy phrase that wants to be put on, like, listen to your heart, follow your dreams, whatever. No, I'm saying know yourself, know something about the biological differences between men and women, know something about yourself as a woman, what your sort of hindbrain impulses are going to encourage you to do. Understand that some of those impulses are, you know, lead to better outcomes than others, that some of those impulses are actually to be restrained and not encouraged. And I would give the same advice to men, by the way, but, you know, our society already gives overboard, like, our society, you know, sort of assumes that all masculine impulses are negative and therefore need some kind of adjustment or restraint. That's obviously not true. But some masculine impulses, just like some feminine impulses, are negative.
Right.
And require the inculcation of virtue to restrain. Right. So I think that's at least the basis of it, of hoping to build a kind of virtuous life as a man or as a woman, is to know what sort of impulses, what sort of impulses your hindbrain is going to send. And then to build structures around yourself that will actually check those impulses instead of give free rein to them, which I think is really the way we've created, frankly, unbearable class, like a certain percentage of unbearable women today, because it's not because they're, like, inherently horrible, or women are inherently horrible. It's because every negative impulse of femininity is magnified and encouraged in our culture. In the same way that every impulse of masculinity is sort of discouraged, right? And the reality is, we need a more nuanced view about which of these either masculine or feminine impulses within ourselves leads to a virtuous and happy life, and which don't. And that's inherently a moral discussion.
Right. Absolutely. Well, hopefully it can be a discussion for another time, because this was fun. And I really enjoy talking to you.
I really enjoy talking with you too. Keep up this podcast, the Anti-Girl Boss podcast. I think that there's, again, I think that there's a lot of space here in our 2022 world for this kind of discussion. I think that there are more people, particularly more women, open to this than there would have been before the pandemic, for sure. I think you're completely right that the pandemic has exposed for a lot of people how lonely their lives actually are, and how sort of the script that has been given to them has not resulted in, at least in happiness beyond sort of the day-to-day distraction. So I think that, again, there's a lot of space for this podcast, and I thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Inez. Have a good one.
You too.